You're listening to a previously recorded Gulf Coast Live. This hour, we're talking about screen time and kids. How much is too much? And when should parents get their kids their own little screen in the form of a smartphone? Later in the show, we'll talk with a woman who made the film titled Screenagers. We'll also hear from the vice president of PBS Kids Digital about public broadcasting's take on screen time and kids. But first, we're talking with a doctor dubbed a mediatrician whose specialty is media and kids. Dr. Michael Rich is an associate professor of pediatrics at Harvard Medical School, an associate professor of social and behavioral sciences at the Harvard School of Public Health, and practices adolescent medicine at Boston Children's Hospital. He's the founder and director of the Center on Media and Child Health, as well as a pediatrician, a researcher, father, and media aficionado. Dr. Rich, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
As always, our phone lines are open for listeners to give us a call if you'd like to join the conversation. The number is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Dr. Rich, how does one wind up as a mediatrician?
Well, I spent my wicked youth in the film industry as a screenwriter and wannabe great American filmmaker. When I got tired of the Hollywood scene and decided to go back to medical school, I thought I'd left it all behind me. But when I entered pediatrics in the early 90s, it became clear that there was increasing concern then about television and its links to obesity and anxiety and violence. I was sort of recruited as someone who knew from behind the camera, if you will, what went into making media. We started doing research to actually move it away from this right and wrong values-based discussion that had been going on about whether kids should see violence, et cetera, to a real evidence-based discussion of how we are changed by the media we use and how we use them.
It was really interesting how the two life paths kind of converged in the end,
right?
Exactly.
But what that did is it allowed me to take a step back and not see, you know, the boob tube, if you will, as the enemy or as the people who made that as trying to hurt our kids or not caring about kids, but understanding that they were people, too, who were just not operating with all the information necessary to really recognize the impact of what they were creating.
Yeah, it is interesting looking at it from another perspective instead of just us against them, right? How does media and screen time rank among parental concerns? I mean, is it up there with questions about nutrition and sun exposure?
As an advisor to Parents Magazine, which did a survey a couple of years back, I was surprised to find that not only was screen time very high in the top four, I believe, but all of the top five or six had relationships to screen time and issues, whether they be obesity or anxiety and depression, substance use, the potential threat of pedophiles. All of those things actually have very strong links to the media we use and how we use them.
And parents are actually concerned about that. Have they kept up with the way that media has changed? I mean, those questions since the early 90s have probably grown into a very loud chorus of questions about smartphones, iPads. When should we do this? When should we even introduce a screen?
Well, that's why I was glad to have had the Center on Media and Child Health up and running before the introduction of smartphones and tablets and the rapid penetration of the Internet of all things in the lives of not only adults, but even very young children.
So do you have a straightforward answer on the question of when to give a kid a smartphone?
Probably not in your idea of a straightforward question in the sense of a certain age.
Yeah.
I think it's more about thinking about smartphones as a tool, a very powerful tool that can do certain things really well. But just as you would not necessarily give a power saw to a child of five because they neither had need for the tool or had the ability to handle it safely, I think we should think about these tools and introducing them to children when the child actually has a need for what it does well, has the ability to take responsibility and self-regulate, and you can sit down with them and say, what are you going to use it for? Here are the things you should not be using it for. And decide with the child what the consequences should be should they overstep their bounds.
So you're talking about maybe more of a tight parental control on apps and the usage of the phone as they introduce that into a teenager's life or a child's life?
Absolutely. I think we have sort of lost touch with the fact that we have to parent in the digital space as much as we parent in the physical space. So if your child is one whom you would not trust with the car because of their judgment or their maturity, we should think about what happens when they're on the phone. The children literally do not have the neurodevelopmental capability to truly protect their privacy and understanding. To them, privacy means so mom and dad can't see it.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't really have the ability, nor should they developmentally have the ability yet, to really understand that they're creating a digital footprint, that there are going to be implications in the short and long term of posting various images, various texts, reaching out to strangers. So we need to be in their lives, and we need to be using these media with the kids and helping guide them just as we guide them through understanding all aspects of their life.
So I wanted to get to the research. Is there solid research into the question of kids and smartphone usage in terms of addiction or negative mental or social consequences, or are those kind of all anecdotal observations that people are throwing at it?
Oh, no, there is a growing body of information. I mean, one of the interesting things we're dealing with in this realm is that the usual pace of public health research has a very hard time keeping up with the pace of technological development and with the pace of how we are evolving in our behaviors with the devices and with each other. So in many ways, we are learning things as quickly as we can, but often the situations posed are a step beyond what we have data from. But the research is being collected. In fact, we have recently at Boston Children's Hospital opened the first dedicated clinic at a academic medical center that deals with kids who have problems with interactive media. We do not call it addiction because this has been an argument in the medical community for two decades, and it has distracted from really focusing on what's going on and how to deal with it. We're calling it problematic interactive media use, which points the fingers at our use, not at the devices, because the devices aren't doing it to us. It's what we're doing with the devices that gets us in trouble. So we are, as at most academic medical centers, not only diagnosing and treating these young people, but we are collecting a lot of scientific research to really characterize what's going on, to really understand how we can intervene effectively and earlier, and in fact, hopefully prevent it once we really understand the predisposing factors and the triggers of these problems.
And the problem being the inability to just kind of walk away from the smartphone.
Exactly. Well, the smartphone walks with you.
Well, yeah, that too. Or just set it down and not pay attention to it. And adults have problems with that too. Is there a correlation between young people who end up in that trap as well as older people? Or are younger people more susceptible to that because they're being introduced to media at a younger age? Their mind is developing with it omnipresent?
Well, I think they are more vulnerable because they have yet to develop their prefrontal cortex, which is executive function, impulse control, future thinking, et cetera. It's why they are such effective learners. They're early adopters of technology. They're the ones who develop all the hacks and all the interesting things to do with it. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of parents check out from this because from parenting them in this space because they are so facile with it. The other relationship that adults have with it is they're on their devices too.
Yeah.
And so a child who hears 1% of what you say when they say, turn off that video game, hears 100% of what you do when you're staring at your own smartphone, answering emails and doing all these terribly important things that we adults do, but to a child, it looks like we're just playing on our phones like they are.
Yeah, like we're also doing the virtual hair salon on Barbie or whatever. Exactly.
Exactly.
So, well, then what do you suggest? Say a parent maybe suspects that their kid is having a difficult time with this. What do parents need to do? Do they need to lead by example first and then establish ground rules in a media diet?
Yeah, I mean, I think for one thing, there is a very good tool online from the American Academy of Pediatrics, which sort of sets up a media menu, if you will, for a family so that you can think, forward about it, think consciously about it. The concept of screen time limits really is quite obsolete now because, you know, this limiting of 1 to 2 hours a day of quality educational screen time, no one could figure out what quality was, what education was. And now kids are getting their homework online. They're getting handed iPads in schools. So instead of that, what we find that the research and empirical experience with our clinic patients shows is that you flip the paradigm upside down. You sit with a child when they're not using media and think of their 24-hour day as an empty glass that they fill up with this many hours of sleep, this many, hours to do homework, to play outside, to do all the things that they like to do, a sit-down family meal every day, which is the single most protective thing you can do, not just for their nutrition, but for their mental health, and then see what's left over. And what you're doing there is, first of all, removing this restriction that creates the forbidden fruit, which ends up in a conflict every single time.
It makes it so much more appealing, right?
Right. And you're teaching the kids to prioritize what they like, to be mindful and thoughtful about their activities, and to manage their time. And God knows we could all do better at time management.
Exactly. If you're just joining the show, we're talking with Dr. Michael Rich. He's Associate Professor of Pediatrics at Harvard Medical School, and he's known as the Mediatrician. We're talking about screen time and when to smartphone. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number to call is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Now I wanted to get into that murky differentiation between media and social media. Here in Florida, we just went through the school shooting in Parkland, where during the event, kids used social media to report what they were seeing, contact family and friends while they were locked down, with parents incredibly grateful for that contact. But in the days and weeks since, we've had a bunch of kids that have been getting into trouble by making threats to schools via that same social media. What do you think about how social media is changing the way that kids interact with the world and in some ways can have kind of a greater impact on it than it did in years past?
Well, I think that this is a perfect example of not blaming the device or the application, but looking at how we work with it. Social media has given folks like Emma Gonzalez voice that she never would have had in the future. She is being heard the way no one has ever been heard before on this issue because of social media. The same exact application with the same exact tools are being used to threaten, and Nicholas Cruz used it to advertise himself as a school shooter before it. So I think that what this tells us is that this is a tool that we need to use in mindful and focused ways, that it is not a problem of social media. It is what we do with it that matters. And if you think about it, social media can be a huge tool of peace, of people connecting with each other in real ways. But in many cases, what we've done is allowed our incredible connectivity to actually isolate us from each other, so we don't have the deep sense of connectedness as individuals and as a community that we may have had when we actually looked up from our phones and looked in each other's eyes and talked not just about all the great things that we do and have, but about our vulnerabilities and about what really matters to us.
Exactly. And, we talked a little bit about the research before, and it's kind of hard for that research to keep pace with technological advancements. But one thing that's been around for a while is these video games. Are people still studying the impacts of video games and violence? I mean, people used to talk about violent video games and even violent TV shows having an impact on kids. Is there any evidence to back that up?
Yes, there's actually good evidence. One of the core sort of initiatives of the Center on Media and Child Health has been to bring together the research done in more than 15 disciplines now that looks at this interface between media and the physical, mental, and social health of young people. And in that process, we have pulled together somewhere around 1,000 good, rigorous scientific papers from a bunch of different perspectives and disciplines using different methodologies. And what they point to is that the use of violent media, whether it be watching movies, playing video games, etc., and there are, of course, variations about between the media, but in general, we've seen consistently one or more of three outcomes. The first has been, and this is probably a really important one, particularly with kids, has been an increase in fear and anxiety, because what we entertain ourselves with increases the apparent prevalence of violence in our world. And violence is actually, thankfully, a pretty rare event in most of our lives. But we entertain ourselves with it, and we become desensitized to it, which happens to all of us. And actually, the third and least prevalent, but most concerning to many people, is that in some young people, and we don't know who they are in advance, it increases their aggressive thoughts and behaviors. It normalizes aggression as a way of resolving conflicts and prevailing.
So we were talking earlier, you talked about the industry, the media industry, I guess filmmaking and things like that. You were talking about that earlier and how we're not really going to, we don't want to vilify the filmmaking world, for example, but because they may not know the impacts that they're actually having on people who are consuming this media. Now that you're mentioning the research that does have this impact, has there been any communication of that research and those findings to game makers, and have game makers been responsive?
Unfortunately, in the past, much of the communication of these data have been in the form of attacks and sort of pointing fingers and laying blame at the doorstep of the game makers and the movie producers. And their response has understandably been to fall into a defensive position, to cite that they're protected under the First Amendment, the freedom of expression. And so this is why we wanted to take this discussion, which has historically, since the early 50s, been a values-based discussion. Children shouldn't see this or shouldn't see that. And shift it to an evidence-based discussion so that, you know, if you take 10 different people, they'll all have 10 different value sets. They'll argue as long as you let them, and they'll walk out with the same value sets. And when one person's values conflict with another person's values, the First Amendment should protect both of them to say what their values are. However, if we can say, here's what we know about how we as individuals, how children are changed by media that they use and how they use them, then we take it off of blame and shame, and we really are looking at, is this a change that I want for myself, for my child? And if not, how can I ameliorate that? How can I change that? And that, I think, is a much more effective approach to the people who are producing it, because then you're on the same side with them. We can do well while doing good. I don't think they have any interest in hurting people. They have an interest in selling product and making money. And so what we need to do is develop a second bottom line, recognizing that we as individuals and as a society are affected and are changed by the media we use. But effectively, we can create something that is good for individuals and good for their business.
Yeah, it makes sense coming at somebody not in an attacking mode, but hey, here's where we're coming from, and I understand what you're saying.
Right.
We have a call coming in from Cape Coral. This is Lakshmi on the line. Lakshmi, what would you like to say?
Hi, Julie. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am a pediatrician. I'm so grateful to be able to talk to Dr. Rich from Harvard. I often come across teenagers who are into gaming. And this has become an issue where, you know, parents totally lose control of these children because they don't know how to control them. This is not something that they've ever been exposed to before. What possible advice would Dr. Rich have under these circumstances?
Okay, thank you for your call, and I'll have him give you that answer offline. Thank you for calling in. So, Dr. Rich, what would be your answer when you have parents that have no way of controlling the amount of gaming that their teenagers are doing?
Well, I would take a step back and say, you don't have no control. You do have control of what your teenagers are doing. Remember, you are still the parent. And in virtually all of the cases, the parent is the one who bought the game in the first place. The parent is the one who pays for the connection online. You know, I believe it was Toni Morrison who says, we are not disempowered by others. We give it up voluntarily. You know, I think that a lot of parents just don't venture into the digital realm. We need to parent children in the digital realm because they spend more of their waking hours in that realm than they do face-to-face with us or in school. So we need to reconfigure this, just like we did when we introduced bicycle helmets, when we introduced safety belts in cars, just because at this stage, we have not controlled it doesn't mean that we can't control it. It is essential that parents step up and sit down with their child, not to wag a finger and say, turn that off, but to play the game with the child, to help, to first of all, show the child that they care and respect about the child, that they want to understand what the child is attracted to in this, and believe me, the kid will beat their pants off within the game, but they will certainly be there as the child's student. And at the same time, they can say, okay, now I finally figured out how to steal cars in Grand Theft Auto. Let's talk a little bit about why you might want to do that and to help parent the child in these places. Sometimes these kids are so hooked in that they need to actually be cut off completely so that they can lower their hyperstimulation, so that they can reset, if you will. But ultimately, parents need to recognize that what we owe our children is a rich and diverse menu of experience from which they are learning. And that includes media, but it includes media in the context of face-to-face relationships with friends and family, with getting enough sleep and getting their homework done and doing their school. And when kids are not able to control it at that level, that is why we've developed a specialty clinic to deliver care to those kids who really tipped over into the place where they have problematic interactive media use.
Yeah, I'm wondering how hard is it for a kid to go cold turkey after they've spent hours and hours on video games per day?
Well, it's very interesting because what I typically do when I see a kid is they will say, oh, I have no problem. I can stop any time. I can limit any time. And so I'll say, okay, for the next week, I want you to go home and limit it to 2 hours a day. And I would say the vast majority, somewhere around 80% of them, come back a week later and they say, I can't do it. And so that's when they have what I call the come to Jesus moment, you know, the moment where they are confronting their own inability to do what they thought they could handle. It's very much like quitting smoking or something like that. And in many cases, surprisingly, when we say, okay, how are we going to progress from here? The child says, I think it will be easier for me to not do it at all than it will be to try to control it.
Wow, that's interesting.
So, you know, because they recognize how hooked in they get and how sort of in the flow state they get when they are gaming. But the great thing about it when they have that moment is they own their recovery. They understand that, you know, and they sort of set up their you know, process of getting destimulated and getting better.
And it's their thing. They're the ones who set the parameters. It wasn't something imposed upon them.
Right. And, you know, with teenagers who are biologically, you know, programmed to rebel against virtually anything their parents
exactly.
says, you know, you don't want to get into that police, you know, struggle, you know, where the parent's policing the child, et cetera. And so, you know, I speak directly with the young person and say, let's plan this together, and let's help you see how you are being manipulated by the game, and you are giving up things. And you'd be amazed at the number of kids who, deeply enmeshed in it, recognize that they're caught. And that they want a way out, they just don't know the way out. This surprised me when I started doing this work, because I sort of expected them to be like an alcoholic who would fight to the death to maintain their habit. But instead, many of them really want to find a way out, but just don't know how to do it.
It's really intriguing work that you're doing. That's all the time we have for this part of the show, though, but I do want to thank my guest, Dr. Michael Rich. He's the Associate Professor of Pediatrics at Harvard Medical School, and he's also known as the Mediatrician. Dr. Rich, I want to thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it. Joining me next is Dr. Delaney Rustin. She's the director of a new documentary film called Screenagers that explores kids and phones and video games and screen time. Dr. Rustin, thanks for joining the show today to share your insights with us.
Great to be here.
So we're exploring the questions, when should kids get their first smartphone and how much screen time is appropriate for kids? If you'd like to join our discussion, the number to call is 877-428-8255. I'm sorry, 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So tell me, Dr. Rustin, why did you decide to make this film?
Well, it was some years ago that I saw the tsunami coming with kids going to be getting cell phones and homework online. And as a mom, I was really struggling with my young teenagers. And as a physician, I really wanted to understand the impact of all this screen time. But really, my work for 20 years now in documentary filmmaking is all about finding solutions. So I dedicated myself to making a film that would bring kids, parents, teachers, everyone together to see the film, and that the film would have a lot of solutions, and that then there would be a lot of community discussions. And, you know, that's over 2 million people have done that so far, because, you know, it's such a big problem.
Exactly.
So people are desperate.
Do you have medical background, too?
Yes, I'm a primary care physician.
Oh, okay. So the film starts with you and your daughter exploring whether she should upgrade her flip phone to a smartphone. How did that go?
Oh, that went horribly. Because, in fact, the film shows my struggling along because I was scared to bring it in the home, and finally I did, and you see in the film how I tried to set up rules, and that didn't work well, and you see my progression of learning all sorts of strategies through my stories and others, of how we help kids to find balance in what is now an avalanche of screen time desire. So it got a lot better. Thanks for asking.
Yeah. Well, so you asked her to explain why she should have her own smartphone, and her response was something along the lines of, my friends have them. I would feel a lot more connected to my friends in the world, and I would look cool, and I'd be able to look busy in awkward situations. Do you think that being able to avoid awkward situations is a good or bad thing for kids who are still kind of developing those social skills?
You know, anytime we know biologically that when there's anxiety, the brain wants to avoid it. Anxiety causes avoidance. And yet the number one way to get over anxiety is to confront it. And the reality is, unfortunately, we just did a survey of 1,200 parents of middle schoolers, and 55% of middle schools are allowing kids to carry phones all day with them. So in middle school, at a key pivotal developmental stage, when kids are feeling judged, judging others, trying to find their voice and very aware of their voice, yes, it's concerning that in the hall breaks, at lunch, they can resort to their personal device as opposed to taking the risk of, hey, trying to talk with a teacher, talk to another peer, you know. So this is, it has a lot of us very concerned, and in fact, just this week we're launching a campaign to empower teachers and parents with all sorts of tools on a website, Away for the Day, which is to get people to take action if they want their schools to have their students put their phones away for the day. So again, I'm all about solutions, and I think there's so many things that the movie has done. For me, when I made Screenagers, it was really about being not just a movie, but a movement. And that's what it truly has become.
I don't know. I'm thinking back to when I was in high school, and I didn't look down at a phone because it was before that time. But I would look down at my feet. I would avoid interaction by just, you know, staring down in the hallways. And I was successful at avoiding interaction with a lot of people throughout much of high school. So I don't know if a phone or just staring at the ground would be a whole lot different. But, I mean, I think everybody kind of does that, though. I mean, I'm an adult, and I still will look at my phone to avoid people sometimes.
Exactly. That, as well as boredom. Our brain has boredom because it's a physiological emotion to make us actually find something else to do. So that the combination absolutely has created a society where we will pull out devices now in most settings where we have any downtime or an awkward situation. But the key thing is that when we put kids in an environment that ideally is pretty engaging, that they're going to be learning new subjects, interacting with peers, that the phone then becomes this device that's all sorts of little emotional upticks and downticks, right? And it's always pulling at them. So if you talk to any middle schoolers, they're constantly pulling out their devices and sneaking it, and they will tell you that. So it's not just like you're saying about awkward situations. It's boredom. It's all sorts of times. And that's what actually the data shows, that for middle schoolers, their academic and emotional well-being will be better supported if there's a way for the day cell phone policy. And you know what's really interesting? Double the number of private schools have a way for the day policies as opposed to public schools. And I think that it really concerns me is that kids in the public education that might not have the family resources as much, this creates a digital divide that I explore briefly in Screenagers that really worries me. When we don't have parental support, finances, et cetera, a lot of kids now, the new babysitter, whether that's school or out of school, is a digital device.
Exactly. And, you know, research shows us that our brains are wired for seeking behavior, and studies are showing that we get a hit of dopamine whenever we seek out and find some new little bit of information. So like you said, it's more than just staring away from people for awkward situations, but it's getting that little hit of, hey, I just figured out something new, or I found something new that I learned about. It could have something to do with the addictive qualities of it and how that could be impacting kids. And then, as you mentioned, that lack of boredom. You know, instead of daydreaming and doodling versus browsing on your phone.
Yeah. There are so many reasons about screens. Really what parents are craving are solutions. And what I found so interesting in making the film is that parents would very openly talk about that they feel overwhelmed. But when it came to talking about what kind of rules they're trying to set, they felt really uncomfortable being filmed because it was like either you're being a helicopter parent and too strict, or you're just being, you know, you've either given up or you feel overwhelmed or you're not doing enough. And it was funny because I actually hadn't planned to put myself in the film. Fortunately, I got other stories, but I realized to really just show in the moment the reality of what so many households are doing, I decided to put myself in the film and to share ultimately the limits and how I created those as a stepping ground for people to say, hey, the research shows that parenting, you do much better for your kids that when you have limits, when you explain why you're doing these limits, when you create them with your kids in whatever way that you can, and then ultimately to have very short conversations. I've created something, a weekly Tech Talk Tuesday, basically, for 2 years now, where we look at data and different talking points, again, to engage kids in conversations, because that's how we're going to create mindful kids, as Dr. Rich was saying, too, in terms of getting them to become aware and realizing that we're in this together, that we have different limits and different ways that we're going to need to use devices at different times. We're not the same, parents and kids. But we all agree that, okay, mealtime, for example, that's going to be a device-free zone, right? Or at whatever those are, and I have many on the website and many in the film. But that kind of solutions, rules, is limits and how to do them is what we need a revolution in. A revolution in parenting and a revolution in the schools about how to create balance around screen time.
Mm-hmm. So where is the film being shown? How can people find it?
Well, it can It's amazing because it's worked so well in my intention. My intention was that it would appeal to kids and teenagers, and they absolutely get a lot out of it, and that it would be seen with parents, adults, teachers, and so anybody can bring it to their school, to their workplace, their church, and that's how it's being seen. It's been in community so that, again, we can find solutions and talk with each other. And as you know, talking about media on the show today, it's just a great touch point. It's not, you know, the normal struggling that's happening in 30% of homes where parents are literally report daily fighting with their kids. Mm-hmm. We want to remove that tension and then have a new place that's more about data, other people's stories, calm the emotions, calm the amygdala, and then start to say, okay, what's most effective? What are our goals? How are we going to achieve those? And from that place, I find that kids really respond and parents feel really empowered. So they go, if you go to Screenagers movie website, it'll say find a screening or organize one. So that's how it's been spreading around the country and many other countries.
All right, and we have links to that at WGCUnews.org or GulfCoastLive.org, where people can find that website on our website. So, that's all the time that we have for this part of the show today, but I want to thank my guest, Dr. Delaney Rustin, the director of the new documentary film called Screenagers. Dr. Rustin, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
It was great. Thank you.
When we come back from this short break, we'll round out the hour with Sarah DeWitt. She is the vice president of PBS Kids Digital. We'll get her to explain what public media is learning about kids and screens. This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. We'll be back.
Hey there, I'm Rachel Iacovone, a reporter here at WGCU. We're in the middle of Radio Uninterrupted, our pledge drive that asks you for donations now, rather than live, during one of your favorite shows. And if one of those shows is a national program, you can feel good knowing your donation is what keeps WGCU as Southwest Florida's NPR member station. You can donate by calling 1-800-533-9428 or by going to wgcu.org/radiouninterrupted.
And what I see from conservatives is this sort of tribal, you know, if these people are against Kavanaugh, we have to be for him. You know, if Kavanaugh has the right enemies, then I've got to be on his side or else those enemies will win. I think that's the main psychological dynamic here.
I'm Michael Barbaro. That's Today on the Daily from the New York Times.
Tonight at 10 on WGCU, NPR for Southwest Florida.
Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Today we've been exploring the questions of when kids should get their first smartphone and how much screen time is appropriate for kids. And anyone who has a kid knows it starts earlier and earlier, with toddlers swiping open iPads and tapping in mom or dad's passcode. A pioneer in developmental programming for kids, PBS has been at the forefront since TVs were housed in large pieces of furniture on shag carpet. And now with the move to digital, PBS is there too. We're joined now by Sarah DeWitt. She's the vice president of PBS Kids Digital. Thanks for being on the show today.
I'm so happy to be here. Thanks.
What is the digital landscape for PBS Kids?
Well, our mission is to be everywhere kids are, and so we need to be as accessible as possible. So we are still on television, and a lot of kids are still watching PBS Kids over broadcast, more kids than you probably even realize. But we also have streaming video apps. We're on devices like Apple TV and Roku. We have a PBS Kids app, and we're on streaming services like Amazon Prime.
So you're getting it out there, pushing it out in all different directions. And mm-hmm. today we're talking about the screen time in kids, and it seems to be a continuing developing terrain. You know, you did a TED Talk recently on this subject, and it's called Three Fears mm-hmm. About Screen Time for Kids and Why They're Not True. What are those fears?
So the fears that a lot of parents have are really kind of what you were talking about earlier, about addictive behaviors, about the fact that these will make kids too sedentary, or could lead to obesity, or that it's making kids really antisocial. And the point I'm really trying to make is not so much that these aren't things we should be worried about. We should be worried about it, but we really need to be thinking more about the content on those screens rather than having the debate just about the devices themselves. I think Dr. Rich said well that these are tools, and what really matters is what's happening on those tools and the ways that we're kind of introducing kids to how to use them appropriately.
Mm-hmm. So we're talking about overuse of the time and screens being passive and not being as interactive, but you're saying that that's one of the first fears, that it's not as passive.
Well, I think content can be created so it won't be passive. So this is a really critical point here that you're raising. Right now, the industry really defines success on these devices, like on your smartphone, by how much time you spend in it. So, you know, the more time you spend on Facebook, the more Facebook is rewarded for that time through advertising revenue. And that same model has trickled down to kids' content. It's a real problem. I mean, if you watch a kid playing a game on a tablet, then again, that game maker is going to be rewarded by the amount of time that kid is spending. And so the game levels never quite end. You just kind of keep sucking them in. And what we're trying to do at PBS Kids is, and several other organizations are doing things like this, is trying to buck that trend, trying to redefine the success. Because if you think about how these devices could work in our lives, they actually could promote behaviors that would have kids move away from the screen. So in the example of getting too sedentary, all of these screens have cameras on them. And so we did an experiment with Chris and Martin Kratt, who were the hosts of the Wild Kratts show on PBS Kids, where you study animal behavior.
I know them well.
And what we... Oh, good.
I have a 7-year-old, yes.
It's a fun show. And in the show, the characters wear creature power suits where they get to be the creature. Well, they asked us, you know, can we use those cameras and those computers and on those phones to let kids feel like they're in a creature power suit? And so we built a game where kids actually stand in front of the computer and they pretend to be bats. And on screen, they're looking at the perspective of bats and they're waving their arms. And when we were doing research on this, when we were doing the early playtesting, after kids played being bats and we turned off the game so that we could start talking to them about it, the kids didn't stop being bats. They still kept flying around the room. They were doing what kids do, which is they got excited about pretending to be that animal and then they didn't want to stop. And they also then remembered the facts that we were sharing with them about bats as they were playing. So I think it's just a shift in how we think about the content we're creating. This screen actually could get a kid up and moving. It could say, inspire them to go outside and look at different leaves and take pictures of them. It could inspire them to run as fast as they can because there's something in it that's measuring how fast they went and can tell them, did you beat your last time? We just have to think really creatively about how to use these tools and how to introduce them to kids.
Well, and a lot of parents may be guilty, though, of just kind of parking their kids with a screen so that they can get on with their, you know, they're at a restaurant. I'm guilty. I will admit it. I'm embarrassed to say it out loud and on the radio. But, you know, you put your kid there with their TV, they're happy, they're occupied, and they're not bothering anybody, and you can enjoy dinner. Is that an issue? Is that something that parents should maybe not do?
Well, here's what I would recommend is think really hard about what are the times when you are going to need screen time as a family. Like, what are the things you want your kids to learn from it? And then what are the times that are best for you for there to be some screen time? And so in my example, it's I really need to have my kindergartner occupied while I'm putting my 3-year-old down for a nap. Like, that's a critical time when I always use screen time. So, you know, this is when parents feel guilty, but if you are willing to do a little bit of work ahead of time and you're willing to follow up on it, it actually can be really powerful. So let's say we have this moment where you know you need some screen time, in your case in the restaurant. You know you need them to be quiet for a little bit so you can have some adult conversation. What you want to do is think in advance about, okay, what are the things that my kid is most interested in right now, or what are the things that I really want them to be learning about, and make some choices about the media that they can experience in that moment. So, you know, maybe your child really loves Wild Kratts, and so you pull up a few of those episodes, or, you know, you also get some Dinosaur Train or a few games about animals. And you say, okay, here are your choices right now. So the child plays one of those. Then the really critical thing is once the food comes and you turn that off, that you engage in a conversation about what just happened on the screen. And you ask them to tell you, which animal were Chris and Martin today? And what did you learn about that animal? Oh, tell me more about that. Do they run faster than this or that? There was a study that came out in 2016, Texas Tech University, did a study of the show Daniel Tiger's neighborhood. And they learned that kids actually were able to develop empathy by watching the show. But there was actually a point where the learning was even greater, the increase in empathy was greater. And that's if the parent had a conversation with the child about what they watched. Just watching did something, and just having a conversation with kids about how other kids felt also did something. But the combination of those two things amplified the result even more. And we see that in our research, too, around particularly math games. That's where we've done some research on this, where if a child watches something that's about math and then has a conversation with their parents about it, they're more likely to remember what they watched. And they're more likely to remember those key skills that are going to be really important for kindergarten readiness. I feel like this is the biggest thing parents can do, is plan ahead for what your kid's going to watch and then have a conversation about it. Because then not only is the child reinforcing what they learned in whatever the educational media is that you chose, you're also developing this habit really early on that media is something that you can talk about. And it's not something that's just, okay, this is my screen time way over here and my mom doesn't know anything about it. It's something that you do and then you talk about together, and you begin to learn to be a critical thinker. You can kind of explore it together. And also, kids this young, the age group we work with, just love to talk to their parents about mm-hmm. what they've done. They love to share. So could it's this, a really kind of fun thing.
Could this also maybe help set the stage for the media habits where they're sharing with their parents? And maybe I'm being too optimistic here. As they head into the teenage years, being mm-hmm. able to continue to share those conversations and keep that media consumption a little bit more open.
That's certainly the hope. You know, I don't know of any research that has tried to, like, guide this over time, but there's a lot of work right now about the importance of being media mentors and being involved. I really think that if you're setting this up early, that media is something to be talked about, and it's something that you also discuss together about what things you're going to do. Now, of course, when kids become teenagers, they're going to want some autonomy, but they still will be in a situation where at dinner they might say, can I tell you about this crazy thing I learned online? Or, you know, the parent might be able to say, how did you beat that level? I walked by while you were playing, and that looked impossible. The idea that this is something that you can talk about, that I can show you what I've done, I feel like that really could carry through. And I think it's good to set up those habits really early.
You said in your TED Talk that you feel that society is missing a huge opportunity for children by fearing screen time. Do you think mm-hmm. that there's how do you overcome parents' fear of screen time? It seems like the more educated parents are the ones that are more keyed in on trying to limit that screen time. Is there any way to get that message to the parents, too?
Yes, I think so. We really have been trying. We've been trying to talk to parents about this and try to get the messages through with our media, too. We know that parents really trust PBS Kids. It's often the first place they let their kids watch. But you're right. It's kind of the parents who are most clued in that are hearing the things about screen time being bad, and they're the ones who are most afraid of letting their kids play with it or use too much of it. And I think parents keep thinking about there's some magic number of minutes at which point it's okay up to this number, and then it's bad after that. And really, it's about the habit. It's about figuring out how this fits into the day. And that's really the message that I think we need to get out to parents. We need content providers to be creating content that isn't just about sucking kids in, but we also need parents to think about, okay, how is this just like any other activity that my kids are doing? Like, there's going to be soccer practice, and there's going to be sitting down to eat dinner together, and there's going to be school time, and then there's also going to be some screen time in there.
And kind of scheduling it out, right?
Right, right.
Like they were talking about earlier, they were talking about there are so many hours in a day. There are going to be this many hours right. for sleeping, this many hours for sitting at the family table and eating, and then this much time for being on the screen.
Right. Dr. Rich described that glass of water that you're filling up.
Yeah.
I thought that was a really great idea. What we've been talking about here is think about it as you do meal planning. A lot of families at the beginning of the week think through, okay, what are we going to eat this week? Because I need to, you know, go grocery shopping and maybe research some recipes and figure out how much time I have each day. And it's the same kind of thing. What are the times this week when it's going to make sense for my kid to have some screen time? And then what are some of the things that I can find that are good good pieces of content for them to play with? And then how am I going to make sure that I have a few minutes to talk to them about it and to learn what they did? Or, you know, if you finish the laundry early, maybe you can sit down and watch a few minutes with them. Kids really think that's pretty cool, too.
Yeah.
So at this age. Have that conversation.
Do you feel like this generation is going to end up being more STEM-oriented as they grow up with these screens around and being so immersed in technology?
Well, I think it, again, kind of depends on the content. I mean, certainly kids are very facile with the technology, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they are going to be better at technological skills. You know, it just means they're really good at using it. This is where we still need to be teaching things like programming literacy, things that kind of help kids understand how are these things created. So it's going to be about what happens on these screens that I think is going to drive that.
I think it's interesting. I'm seeing coding games out there for kids, for little mm-hmm. tiny kids, where they can start
right.
learning coding so early.
We actually have, PBS Kids has a Scratch Junior app, and it's created by MIT and Tufts, and it really is for preschoolers. It's kids 4 and 5. And if you look at it, you know, someone who doesn't know programming will look at it and say, oh, this is like a storytelling tool. You put different blocks together to decide, is the character going to walk across the screen to the right or to the left? Are they going to jump up and down? What are they going to say? But it really is taking those coding basics and putting it into a context that makes sense for kids that young and helping them understand that it's actually about logic. And MIT and Tufts have just done a ton of research on this, about you really can begin to learn these concepts very early, and that's probably going to help them throughout their lives.
Well, it's almost like learning another language.
Right? Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's all the time that we have for our show today, but I want to thank my guest, Sarah DeWitt. She's the Vice President of PBS Kids Digital. Sarah, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And thanks also to my earlier guests, Dr. Michael Rich, the mediatrician at Harvard Medical School, and Dr. Delaney Rustin, the director of a new documentary that's called Screenagers. You can find links to all of our guests today on today's show at gulfcoastlive.org. Our show today was produced by Mike Inire and Rachel Iacovone. Our director is Richard Chin Kui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers, 90.1, WMKO Marco Island, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.
On a trip back from Orlando recently, I was driving down US 27 with my daughter listening to WMFE, and as it started fading out around Sebring, I switched over to see if we can pick up WGCU, and there it was, coming through loud and clear. I was like getting reminders like that, just how far WGCU's signal carries and how much we could mean to some listeners outside of what we might normally think of as our listening area. So if you're listening to me now up in Sebring or Lake Placid, we want to hear from you during this, our Fall 2018 Radio Uninterrupted Pledge Drive. We've been doing these for several years in order to shorten the live on-air drives when we do cover up some parts of the shows. And it's been working, but only because of ongoing support from listeners all across Florida. Thanks for being a WGCU listener, and please consider taking it one step further and becoming a member today by calling 1-800-533-9428 or by going to wgcu.org/radiouninterrupted and making your gift of support. You decide what we're worth. No amount is too small. Thank you.